Good evening, friends. So last week on Halloween, God, that seems so long ago. I shared a quote with you from Lorraine Hansberry. I wish to live because life has within it that which is good, that which is beautiful, that which is love. Well, all these years, I thought that that quote was taken from a journal entry that she wrote or that she made right before she died. Actually, it turns out that this was a quote delivered in a speech in 1959, 6 years before she had passed. So I'm sharing this because the truth really mattered to Lorraine, and she wouldn't want me lying on her, so. And the truth matters. Facts matter. And when we put mis-memes out in the world, it's important to name that, to learn from that, and to change our behavior if necessary, right? So I've been carrying this quote around with me in my heart for years. And what this has taught me is that even if I think I know, I need to like double check and triple check. I need a fact checker. So. So last night after Dara's talk on the Four Noble Truths, the teachers, we were all in the staff dining room. And they could see that I was a little concerned about this talk, a little nervous. So it got a little silly back there. And it got a little silly, I think, out of kindness for me. So out of kindness, Dara said, "You're talking about joy? You need to go listen to some gospel music." And then I think Greg said, "Yeah, you should bring some gospel music into the hall tomorrow and play it." And then Winnie was like, "Yeah, you should start clapping and singing." And I'm imagining myself tap dancing. And I'm seeing all of this. I'm like, this is so not going to happen in the hall tonight. That is not what's going to happen in this hall. Maybe at a future retreat with a different structure, but not tonight. So I was reading one of my, just a poet that I'm really in love with right now. His name's Padre Gotuma. And he has this spiritual biography. And in it, he talks about sign language and the sign for courage. And the sign for that is doesn't that like say it all? I love words and I love language because the consonants and the vowels and the timbre and the rhythm and the meaning are all pointing to some direct felt experience. And in this case, it's a gesture. And it got me to thinking, what would be some of the signs that we would use to convey these Pali words that we have a direct experience of. Words like piti and sukha and pamoja. So I was just playing around. And I was just feeling into piti, which Winnie alluded to the other night. She talked about it as a rapt interest. Some of you have reported feeling rapture in your sits and your meditations. There's this quality of uplift in the mind. And for me, it feels like this zesty freshness in the mind and the body. and it can feel like cool stars just sparkling throughout the body, like an infinite number. So I was feeling into piti, and I thought, well, the sign for piti could be piti. Piti. And then sukha is happy contentment. And just resting, satisfied, has this sweetness, sukha, maybe sukha. And then pamoja and gladness. At least in the 16 steps of mindfulness, it's that moment when the activity within the mind actually starts to settle. And it's been described as this gladness and happiness that arises when, I have a teacher that talks about it, you have contact with the direct nakedness of the mind, the suchness of the mind. There's this sense of a deep, quiet, profound gladness that's born of a relief and a rest. Pamoja. Pamoja. There's no sign language for Pali words, but I was just playing around. It was fun. So these words point to a direct felt experience of really wholesome mind states that are quite pleasant in their feeling tone. For the most part, piti, when it gets really intense, can start to feel a little ruckus in the system. These wholesome forms of joy can really be a balm for the heart, in the mind, and the body. And they feel like a balm because they're, for me at least, a temporary oasis from the conventional forms of happiness that I've known, or the habitual unwholesome states that my mind can get into. Can be a real balm for the mind because it can be so inspiring, it can be so onward leading, because these states, these wholesome factors of joy, it's like a foretaste of what a free heart and mind actually feels like. And it can be so heartening, it can just kind of carry us along the path. I think most importantly, it's these wholesome forms of joy are a ground out of which tranquility and insight arise. And this joint effort, this joint relationship between insight and tranquility prepares the heart and mind for the breakthrough to Nibbana. Isn't that interesting? That tranquility and insight prepare the heart to release, to let go into Nibbana. And these wholesome states of joy open the mind to tranquility and insight. So no wholesome forms of joy, no tranquility and insight, no Nibbana. Like, wholesome forms of joy are integral to our awakening. Think of it another way. You can think of these wholesome forms of joy as a precursor to Nibbana. Nibbana has been described as a profound peace, the highest happiness, an unshakable deliverance of mind. The Majjhima Nikaya describes it in this way. This is peaceful. This is sublime. Namely, the calming of all constructions. the letting go of all supports, the extinguishing of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. Like, can you hear the tranquility and the peace and the letting go that are being intimated? This is peaceful. This is sublime. Namely, the calming of all constructions, the letting go of all supports, the extinguishing of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. So there's a monastic, he doesn't live far from here, his name's Venerable Anālya. I found him to be very kind, clear, really honest about his shortcomings. And at times his sense of humor can be really kind of impish and playful, and he can be quite light. And he's no slacker. He's one of our foremost Buddhist scholars. His area of study is early Buddhism. And he's a very deep and dedicated practitioner. An example of this is he was teaching at Spirit Rock last year, and he came down to the family, one of our family days, to work with one of our children's groups. And I love kids because they just kind of get right to it. And this kid asked, "What's the longest you've ever sat?" And he answered, 12 hours. Wait for it. I usually sit 8 hours. And then Jill, Brian, and I, and actually some of you also sat this retreat, during a Q&C, it was revealed that he now sits 14 hours a day and 1 hour of walking. Okay. This dude is not a slacker. And through his studies and his practice, he's come to summarize this gradual training, this path that we've all embarked on, as, quote, "This training can be envisaged as a progressive refinement of joy." A progressive refinement of joy. So cultivating wholesome mind states that are rooted in joy. We enter into these states of joy. We let go of one state and enter into another that's a little more refined, a little less coarse. And I'm not suggesting that our practice is this uninterrupted field of joy. Like, your practice and your days here are revealing to you that that's not the case. And it's really easy to become enamored of these states, partly because the Vedana is so pleasant. And there's a deep biological imperative to seek pleasant sensory experience. And it can be really easy to start to crave and cling these wholesome states of mind. So here's a stanza from the Dhammapada that'll support us in relating wisely to these wholesome states of joy. "The mindful apply themselves. They don't amuse themselves in any abode. Like swans flying from a lake, they abandon home after home. The mindful apply themselves. They don't amuse themselves in any abode. Like swans flying from a lake, they abandon home after home." So as I was preparing for this talk, I was reminded by Guy Armstrong, who's one of the teachers here, that these states don't always show up for us initially. And that's totally okay. That it takes time for these wholesome, forms of joy to actually ripen within our heart and our mind. And that if you are experiencing them, or you're not experiencing them, or you don't experience them on this retreat, that it's okay. It's not a cause for worry. By virtue of the fact that we're practicing, we're planting the seeds for these wholesome states to arise in the future. And I'm also reminded that as we sit, it's easy for the mind to get fixated on those aspects of practice that can feel quite challenging and difficult. And it's important to remember what Winnie was talking about a couple of nights ago, too. It's so timeless here, I forget where we are. She talked about the four wise efforts, and two of those efforts is to arouse and sustain wholesome mind states. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. Develop what is skillful. It's possible to develop what is skillful. If it were not possible to develop what is skillful, I would not say to you, develop what is skillful. But because it is possible to develop what is skillful, I say to you, develop what's skillful. Sometimes I love imagining the arahants and some of my favorite monastics like Upalavana just cheering me on. And I hear the Buddha cheering us on in this. Develop what is skillful. It's possible. If it wasn't possible, I wouldn't tell you to develop what's skillful. And he goes on to say, if this development of what is skillful were conducive to harm and pain, I would not say to you, develop what is skillful. So there's the compassion. He's cheering us on, and then there's the compassion. But because this development of what is skillful is conducive to benefit and pleasure, I say to you, develop what is skillful. So through the four wise efforts, we're actually broadening our view and broadening the lens of mindfulness to include wholesome, to include the wholesome movements of the heart. And we learn to recognize our own goodness, the goodness of others, the goodness of the circumstances that we find ourselves in. And one way of connecting with goodness is through sila, or virtue, what Temple Smith, a teacher who actually did a lot of his training here, calls training the heart in ethical attunement. So sila, ethical attunement, virtue. So earlier this morning, actually early on in the retreat, and this morning, you took the precepts and the refuges. And taking the precepts regularly can be such a grounding for our own heart and training the heart in this ethical attunement. And it can be really important for us to use language and imagery that is really idiosyncratic to us, because it helps us to wholeheartedly commit to non-harming. And sometimes I'll just, when I'm taking the precepts, I'll just imagine that I'm seeding my whole body with each precept. It's as if I could fill the entire body with this intention of non-harming. And then it serves as a North Star for me throughout the day. So when I feel myself starting to veer from this intention, it's like there's this not quite right feeling in the body, and there's this like, stop. You're about to talk smack about somebody. Just stop. Or you're about to read something that's not addressed to you, which in a way is a form of taking what's not offered. And I bring this up because the precepts aren't commandments. We're not aiming for perfection. And we're certainly not using them as fodder for the inner critic to pummel us, right? there are times when we will not live up to and embody the precepts. And in those instances, regret may arise over our actions, our words. And that's actually okay. That regret that arises is teaching us something. It's letting us know that we're not living in accord with our values, and it can motivate us to make amends and learn from our past so that we're more likely to live from our values in the future. And what's helped me to work with this and a regret around my actions or some unskillful speech is the research of Brené Brown. And she's a professor of research at, I think, Houston University. I'm not sure. But she does make this distinction between guilt and shame that I find quite important. She defines shame as an intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we're flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. That there's something that we've done or experienced or failed to do that makes us unworthy of connection, unworthy of being in relationship. Whereas she defines guilt, and this is what was quite helpful for me. She says it's adaptive and helpful. It's holding something that we've done or failed to do up against our values and feeling the psychological discomfort of that. Can you feel the difference between those two things? Shame arises when we've mistakenly believe that there's something fundamentally wrong with us, that we're wrong or bad, and therefore change becomes quite impossible, right? But guilt, for me at least, is born of a sense of respect for myself, respect for other people, respect for all of life. And seeing that my actions are actually out of alignment with my values, and then feeling into that gap and the pain of that, of being out of integrity, and allowing that to motivate me to change, to make amends, so I can make a different choice in the future. So we're training the heart to be ethically attuned, kind of feeling into what will support the health and well-being of everyone in the immediate environment or beyond. And even here on this retreat, you might be feeling into the wholesome effects of being a part of the Sangha. That everyone in this room is doing their best to embody and live the precepts. Not perfectly, but we're doing our best. And that's saying a lot in this world. I was raised in a family where the precepts were broken pretty frequently. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so grateful to my Dharma friends, my Dharma family, my teachers and my mentors, their trustworthiness has helped me feel a sense of safety and ease. I think it's one of the reasons I love practicing and being a part of Dharma communities where people are committing to non-harming. And whether you know it or not, you're probably feeling the wholesomeness of the field of sila that's kind of floating within you internally. That you have a heart and a mind and a body that's softened by this lack of turmoil that's the result of just wholeheartedly committing to non-harming, right? This lack of remorse from living in alignment with the precepts. And the Buddha really encouraged us to reflect and rejoice in this lack of remorselessness. This lack of remorse, sorry. This is from Ajahn Suchito's book, Samadhi is Pure Enjoyment. Our effort in mindfulness is to maintain integrity in terms of bodily action, words, and even intention. Then to recognize, so this is the recollection, then to recognize and draw on the uplifting qualities of such conduct. He goes on to say, we dwell on the heart-opening effects of recognizing that no creature need fear or mistrust us. We dwell on the heart-opening effects of recognizing that no creature need fear or mistrust us. So sila is not only a protection for others, it's a protection for ourselves, and it's a source of wholesome joy. And the Buddha called this the bliss of blamelessness. So out of this ethically attuned heart, we're sensitizing ourselves to what is wholesome. And then joy arises. And what's great about this is you don't have to work at creating joy. You just have to tend. You just have to tend to and strengthen sila, and then joy just naturally arises. This is from the Buddha. For one who is free from remorse, there is no need to wish, may gladness arise in me. Friends, it is in accord with nature that in one who is free from remorse, gladness will arise. So as this teaching demonstrates, lack of remorse, or sila, becomes the foundation for the development of these wholesome forms of joy. Joy like piti and sukha and pamoja. What makes them wholesome is they're rooted in sila. What also makes them wholesome is that they're arising when the hindrance are in temporary, they're just dormant temporarily. And we're no longer, the mind isn't casting about looking for happiness through sense experience. So these wholesome mind states arise from within. So just a word about non-sensual pleasure. So we do as lay people, or sure for monastics as well, but I don't know. We do derive pleasure from sense objects. And you may experience this here on retreat, right? You're enjoying the warmth of a hot cup of tea in your hands. Or taking a warm shower. Or after a long day of practice, sliding into your bed and just fully feeling the body relax and let go. Kind of drift off into sleep. So there's nothing wrong with this kind of pleasure. But the trouble begins when our mind starts casting about, looking for relief from dukkha through pleasant sensory objects. Instead of actually having an honest encounter with dukkha, so that it can be understood and abandoned, as Dharal was talking about last night, we're in the habit of taking the edge off of dukkha through seeking pleasant sense objects or our projection of pleasant on sense objects. And this keeps us beholden to like the precarious nature of sense objects, right? And in the suttas, when the hindrance of sense desire actually breaks and it abates, it talks about, it uses the imagery of being debt-free. It says that we've been released from a debt, that we've been relieved of a debt. And this, this system of craving, which synonymous with wanting, but is also a shorthand for the relationship between delusion and greed and aversion. So the delusion, this belief that happiness will persist if we accumulate as many positive experiences as possible, as if we could accumulate them, and keep the negative ones at bay, that this will result in our happiness. And so out of this deluded belief, we're constantly like looking outside of ourselves for happiness. So in a way, our happiness is beholden to these objects outside of us. That's the debt. And to be released is to be relieved from that debt. To be released from sense desire is to be released and relieved from that debt. And you can see this quite clearly when unpleasant Vedana hits. And this is from the Samyutta Nikaya. An untaught worldling experiences pleasant feelings, and untaught worldling is someone who hasn't quite been trained in the practices of awakening. So an untaught worldling experiences pleasant feelings. They experience painful feelings, and they experience neutral feelings. So they experience all three forms of Vedana. And he goes on to say, a well-taught noble disciple likewise experiences pleasant, painful, and neutral feeling. Now, what's the difference between these two? And he goes on to say, when an untaught worldling is touched by a painful bodily feeling, they worry and grieve, they lament, beat their breast, weep, and are distraught. They thus experience two kinds of feeling, a bodily painful feeling and a mental painful feeling. So the reactivity is that mental painful feeling. It's as if a person were pierced by a dart, the initial physical painful feeling, followed by, and then is hit by a second dart, this reactivity in the mind. So the person will experience feelings caused by two darts. But check this out. Having been touched by the painful feeling, they resist and resent it. Then in them, who so resists and resents the painful feeling, an underlying tendency of resistance against the painful feeling comes to underlie the mind. Sometimes it's translated as invade the mind. So there's this resistance. And under the impact of the painful feeling, they then proceed to enjoy sensual happiness. And why do they do this? An untaught worldling does not know any other escape from painful feelings except the enjoyment of sensual happiness. Then in this person who enjoys sensual happiness, an underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feelings comes to underlie or invade the mind. They do not know, according to the facts, the arising and ending of these feelings, nor the gratification, the danger, and the escape connected with these feelings. It just so accurately describes our human condition. We experience pain, and then we look for a relief through pleasant sensory objects, pleasant sensory experience. And then we create this underlying tendency, this habit of running from dukkha into this false refuge of sense pleasure. And I want to be really clear about sense pleasure, and that part of our practice may entail using pleasant sensory experience wisely. There may be some trauma that arises, and we use pleasant sensory experience to help us reclaim a sense of safety in the body. This is using sensory experience wisely. Or perhaps the mind just gets out of balance because it's in this hindrance storm, or there's some defilement or some pattern that the gravitational pull has just gotten so strong we get caught up in the content of it. We might use pleasant sensory experience to help the mind come back to balance. That's a wise use of sensory experience. But we also have an opportunity to intervene on this other pattern through letting go of the habit of looking for lasting, or looking for like the sense of this sensory experience is going to do it for me for like the next 20 minutes, and then I just need to find something for the next 20 minutes. So intervening on that pattern, so that we stop trying to take refuge in these transitory experiences of sense pleasure. So with piti and sukha and pamoja, the Buddha's actually pointing to a happiness that isn't subject to the whims of the precariousness of sensory experience. These wholesome forms of happiness actually well up from inside us. And in abandoning the hindrances, especially the one around sense desire, we're letting go of a quite coarse form of happiness for a more refined, deep, it's like a deep inside happiness. Guy Armstrong talks about it in this way. The mind is finding the quality of being contented within itself and isn't looking outside itself anymore. So there's a shift in our orientation over time from an outward focus to an inward focus. So the reason I've been calling on piti and sukha and pamoja is that they show up in three really important maps of freedom that the Buddha has given to us. Piti shows up in the seven factors of awakening, which I think we're going to have a talk on. And it's the qualities of heart and mind that we start to build some strength around, and they come into balance and they lead to awakening. And then pamoja, piti, and sukha show up in the transcendent dependent arising map. That's a mouthful. And it looks at the conditioned arisings that lead from suffering to full liberation. Poja, piti, sukha. And then in the 16 steps of mindfulness, the order is piti, sukha, pamoja. And that's just a detailed practice that uses, it's not just. 16 steps of mindfulness is a really elegant, subtle, and detailed practice given to us by the Buddha that uses the breath as a way to develop calm, tranquility, and insight that again leads to awakening. And when these wholesome factors of joy are present, there's a real natural, lawful unfolding that feels like it's cascading. Right? So whether you're in the seven factors of awakening or transcendent dependent origination or the 16 steps of mindfulness, the progression unfolds in this way, essentially. There's some form of wholesome joy, and naturally out of that joy, tranquility arises. And out of that tranquility, some deeper, more quiet joy, happiness arises. And out of this deeper, quieter contentment or joy, samadhi arises. There's some stability and steadiness of mind. And the energies of the body and the mind start to gather around our chosen object of awareness. And you've had moments like this where the mindfulness is really strong and you see some of your habitual patterns. You see it just the like the birth of a thought or the impulse to fantasize or the impulse to run that pattern again. And the mind just goes, It's so subtle. It's just a like, no. And the mind just comes back to the breath or whatever your object is, whether it's resting the awareness in the hands or scanning the body or sounds in the room or the felt sense of the breath. And there's just this loyalty and a fully, wholeheartedly giving yourself over to the object of your awareness. Wholly, like this, just this surrender and this contentment. And in that moment, your heart and your mind, they don't want to be anywhere else. They're just, heart is content where it is. Concentration naturally arising. So just so you get a sense of this cascading effect, this lawful unfolding that you don't need to will. For one free of remorse, there is no need for an act of will. May gladness arise in me. It is natural that gladness will arise in one who is free from remorse. For one who is glad, there is no need for an act of will or the wish. May joy arise in me. It is natural for one glad that joy arises in them. For one who has joy, there's no need for an act of will or the wish. May my body be tranquil. It is natural for the joyful mind that their body will be tranquil. For one of tranquil body, there is no need for an act of will or wish. May I feel happiness. It is natural for one who is tranquil that they will feel happiness. For one who is happy, there is no need for an act of will or wish. May my mind be concentrated. it is natural for one who is happy that their mind will be concentrated. For one who is concentrated, there is no need for an act of will. May I know and see reality as it is. It is natural for a concentrated mind to know and see reality as it is. So this is where insight arises naturally. We start to see into the nature of things. And this is from Bhante Inalio's book, Satipatthana Meditation, A Practice Guide, which was just recently published. We become able to discern the true nature of existence, in particular its nature of being subject to impermanence. Seeing the changing nature of all aspects of experience naturally leads on to the cultivation of dispassion, to a gradual fading away of craving and attachment. In a way, we are letting the implications of impermanence sink into the mind. We are allowing the flow of change to wash away our craving and attachments. As our craving and attachments fade away through dispassion, we become increasingly able to be at peace with the ending of things, this is cessation. We're willing and able to allow things to cease. So notice that he said, we become increasingly able to be at peace with the endings of things. We become increasingly able. Because sometimes when we encounter the bare experience of reality, it can be a shock to the system. It can be a real shock to our conventional orientation to reality, and it can be quite unsettling. And in those cases, it is so important to just check in with your teachers. Don't check in with me. And the reason I say this is because this is just starting to unfold for me. So I don't know how to guide people through this. Check in with them. They do. They have survived it. You can lean into their faith. You can, because it can be quite, as I said, shocking, scary. And like I said, they've survived it. So you can just, again, lean into their faith. And this much I do know is to just trust mindfulness. It is like your best friend through this whole process. It's like holding the hand of mindfulness and not to let it go. Don't let it go. Because mindfulness will see us through, right through liberation. So we start to see into the nature of reality, the impermanent nature. And this impermanence starts to wash away our attachments and cravings. We start to drop into a state of dispassion. And dispassion starts to help us see the endings of phenomena, of our experience. And we're actually able to, as Bhante said, allow things to end. So we're actually into states of cessation. And he talks about it as sometimes we're so enamored of the next experience, the new experience, that we're leaning in for the next spoonful of experience. But with cessation, we just rest and we allow things to cease. And he goes on to say, this serves to go beyond the average unbalanced attitude of only wanting what is young and new, ignoring what is old and decaying. by attending to the cessation of phenomena, to their ending, we arrived at a more balanced vision. It becomes more and more clear that cessation is not frightening, but actually peaceful. The more we're able to allow things to end, to be at ease with cessation and recognize peacefulness, the better we will be at letting go. Gradually letting go of all remaining attachments prepares us for the supreme letting go, the plunge into the deathless, the realization of nibbana. From the Majjhima Nikaya again. This is peaceful. This is sublime. Namely, the calming of all constructions, the letting go of all supports, the extinguishing of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. I want to look at this moment of letting go into nibbana from another perspective. It's a poem by Maddie Weingast. He's written a collection of poems, and I don't know if it's been published or it's about to be published, but it's inspired by the enlightenment poems of female arahants. This is a poem by Patachara called Wandering Robe. Farmers turn up the soil, plant seeds and wait. All by itself, water pours down from the sky and turns earth into food. I keep all the precepts and always wake before dawn. Sound familiar? I don't pretend to know more than I do. And when others ask for help, I do what I can. After all these years, where is my harvest? Late one night, I was washing my feet after another long day of sitting and walking. The water poured over my feet and onto the ground. I let my mind go, and it flowed downhill with the water toward my little hut. I went inside, sat on the bed, and lowered the wick of the lamp. All by itself, the flame went out. So let's sit for a moment. Farmers turn up the soil, plant seeds, and wait. All by itself, water pours down from the sky and turns earth into food. I keep all the precepts and always wake before dawn. I don't pretend to know more than I do, and when others ask for help, I do what I can. After all these years, where is my harvest? And late one night, I was washing my feet after another long day of sitting and walking. The water poured over my feet and onto the ground. I let my mind go, and it flowed downhill with the water toward my little hut. I went inside, sat on the bed, and lowered the wick of the lamp. All by itself, the flame went out. Whatever your aspirations are for practice, may the conditions come together for their realization, and may the realization of your aspirations be for the benefit of all beings.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.